My first degree is in business, so I was a marketing and MIS major. Graduated with marketing computers. Now what do I do? I work for IBM. They have the best sales training in the world. Then after 2 years, I'll know what I want to be when I grow up, and then I can go do it because I have this great training. I can do whatever I want. And it took me 7-8 years to discover the profession of landscape architecture. And I thought, wow, that's the greatest profession there is, but no one knows what you do. My biggest fear when making the career change was, okay, I have 5 weeks vacation, I'm making a ton of money, and I can travel wherever I want to. So I'm not going to be able to do this as a landscape architect. I had this this kind of vision. It just kind of came to me where I literally was standing on the top of this really pointed mountain, and there was another pointed mountain, and I was taking this leap of faith to get there. And I just looked back and thought, I love what I'm doing, but I want to promote the environmental issues that are important to me. And so I just took a deep breath and then jumped.
You literally had the vision you described?
Yeah. My name is Barbara Deitch, and I'm the executive director of the Landscape Architecture Foundation here in Washington, D.C.
I'm Lita Meritz, and this is Remarkable Objects, a podcast from Deep Root about the intersection of nature and the urban environment. Barbara did more than just switch careers. That vision she had eventually led her to the Landscape Architecture Foundation, an organization dedicated to investing in the profession through research, scholarship, and leadership programs. She and her small team have been trying to drive sustainable design decisions by quantifying the benefits provided by landscape elements like plants and water. For the past 6 years, they've been developing a collection of over 100 case studies from various projects, mostly across the United States. They call this collection of case studies the Landscape Performance Series. Each case study evaluates the contributions of the landscape in 3 areas: social, environmental, and economic. You can sort through the library by drilling down into each of those 3 areas, or by searching for specific site features, like native plants or green roofs or traffic calming. The purpose of the case studies is to arm designers and policymakers with hard, research-driven evidence of the dollar value benefit of the urban landscape. By bringing the business practice of measuring performance to the outdoors, they're creating a tool to change minds and policies, and ultimately the places where we live and work. How would you explain what landscape performance means to someone who isn't steeped in it all day, every day like you are?
Well, I kind of break it down into its component parts. Inherent in that is an understanding of what is landscape. Landscape is designing for natural processes, natural resources, and people. And then introducing this idea of performance, so how something achieves its intended purpose. So if the purpose is to achieve sustainability, then how is landscape contributing to that? In our case, we're looking at sustainable landscape solutions. So how are these projects, these landscapes, helping to achieve sustainability? Building regulators, policymakers, even the general public understand what you can do in a building to be more environmental or sustainable. But there was little, if any, awareness, this was 6 years ago, about what you can do in a landscape to achieve sustainability. So how do we assert the landscape perspective in planning, design, and development?
You mentioned bringing the perspective of landscape architects, you know, to design. Is that where some of the idea for the Landscape Performance Series started?
Well, that that program came about, let's see, that came about because, you know how sometimes things drive you nuts and then you have to figure out solutions. I think what was driving me nuts is this idea that, wow, landscape architecture has a lot to offer to help achieve sustainability. But we need, just like the IBM marketing training, sales training, you need to show the value of what you do in order for others to be more open to receiving it or to value it. And so the concept of the Landscape Performance Series was basically integrating a basic business practice of performance planning, measurement, evaluation, and documentation. So we have built a body of knowledge, a consistent body of knowledge, that then we have data or content in today's terms that you can then use to show the value or make the case for more sustainable landscape architecture.
Here's how it works. Each fall, they have an open call for applications, and landscape architects submit their projects to be considered. LAF is looking for sites that include unusual or notable design elements that advance sustainability. Over a period of about 6 months, projects that are selected are researched, evaluated, and quantified. Teams use a variety of tools to gather and quantify data, like on-site user surveys and a program like iTree and even thermometers. After that process is completed, each site is written up into a case study and published on the Landscape Performance Series website. Academic partners are required, creating a unique collaboration that brings together landscape architecture theory and practice. It's taken LAF a few years to refine this approach, and of course, there have been a few bumps along the way. I think it's interesting to kind of contrast expectation and reality. Sometimes they're close together and sometimes they're not. Can you talk a little bit about what you expected out of this effort and the ways in which it has either, you know, fulfilled those expectations or not?
I think when we first started with the program, thought, oh, this will be easy. We just developed this template, and you have the quantified water waste and energy benefits and a cost-benefit analysis, and you just do it. And then we had the reality. Practitioners, designers, in their scope of work, they aren't commissioned to do this. They don't necessarily have the time to do it or feel confident in knowing the methods or survey science or some data collection tools. So when we first started, we thought, okay, these case studies will just come flying in because everyone will want to promote what they're doing. And we realized when we piloted it with our board members who are leaders in the profession and none of them could do it, we're like, oh no, now what do we do? So that's when we just kind of step back and took a deep breath and then adopted the Buddhist mantra to just start where we are. So we decided to invest in faculty researchers with their research assistants to work with the designers in a unique collaboration to identify exemplary projects and understand the project goals and objectives, develop the metrics and methods, collect or synthesize any data, determine the performance benefits, and then document it into our case study format. That's how we went about investing in the profession and the marketplace, both in bridging that gap between practice and academia, work together to develop these case studies, which provide the content for a variety of decision makers. So we are, through this process, building content for others that they couldn't do on their own. And we're also integrating this basic business practice into design practice. So that's a way of transforming practice.
There are now over 100 case studies in the library, each different and none perfect. Some of the earlier ones, before academic researchers were involved in the process, are a little less comprehensive. But all of them contain innovative designs that prioritize sustainability, and they are all peer-reviewed before being published. What kind of reaction do you get from the design community when you talk about high-performance landscapes or quantifying landscape performance?
I think people at first were a little, oh no, we don't want the pendulum to swing all the way over to this quantification. You know, what about beauty and the inherent feeling and experiential value of a place? But I think now people realize that it's not either or, that it is both. That the landscape needs to function. We want it to function because we're all interested in, you know, doing what we can to help with these larger society and environmental issues, whether you're talking global warming and climate change and adaptation and mitigation, whether you're talking about species extinction or urbanization. You know, we've we've doubled the amount of people in the last 50 years, and they all need a place to live, work, rest, and play. And certainly as landscape architects, that's what we do. It's for multiple benefits for people and for the environment. So recognizing that it is a way, it's a tool to help show the value of what we do so that we can do more of it. I think that's important. There have been times where it has been form versus function, but I think now people realize it has been, it should always have been both, and it needs to be both because we have these larger goals.
There is a lot of research that's done about the landscape, obviously, although not all of it puts dollar values on things. So I'm interested in what trends you've seen now that you've done so many of these and whether you've found anything unexpected.
I think, of course, as a landscape architect or systems thinker, we all wanted to look across the 100 case studies and look for commonalities or gaps or strengths or weaknesses, do the old SWOT analysis. And we are in the process of doing that across the first 60 case studies to look for common metrics and methods and for different types of performance benefits. So when you're evaluating how something's performing, sometimes it doesn't perform the way you it doesn't work the way you wanted it to. And that could be a result of the design solution or a change in the process or that something wasn't implemented as designed or it got value engineered out and that made a critical difference. So we try to include that in the case studies because it's really powerful to learn from what didn't work as well as what did work. And it also takes so people to feel comfortable exposing themselves to, we tried this and it didn't work. But I think people are getting more and more comfortable sharing that.
There's another driver to quantify landscape benefits, which is that clients like data. It reduces the element of risk in their decisions. But it's tricky to do with a living thing, like the landscape, that changes shape over seasons and years.
Any bottom line thinking requires that you quantify benefits. And so this has always been challenging for landscape, right? Because of the spatial and temporal issues involved. You can't just contain it and read the electric meter or the water meter. So to your question about actual and predicted and the type of responses that we're working on, again, we're starting where we are and to get actual performance data versus predicted. Now, that being said, I know some decision makers, predictive data is fine, especially when you're dealing with some stormwater calculations and modeling and other aspects therein. So you'll see a range of different types of data or performance benefits. Some are predictive, some are actual, but we're moving the needle to more methods and an understanding and experience in how to actually enhance site analysis to look towards these larger goals and to be able to communicate the value of them therein.
I want to address the inherent complication with measuring something that is always changing and maybe to have like a brief discussion over how we can continue to improve given that we are always looking at snapshots.
Yeah, we're always looking at snapshots. And so the question is the art of what snapshot to take and how to interpret it, recognizing that some may be perfect and some may not. You may not be ever able to come up with the perfect metric, but then look at things in context. So landscape is all about context and understanding that, and then the same way with evaluation and interpretation. Yeah, it means you have to keep assessing it over time to understand how it's working so you can do it better, right? I mean, that's, again, the process of evaluation is for self-improvement, continuous improvement processes. And since the landscape is always changing, you always want to go back and check so you can see how you can do it better next time or how you need to adapt. Because you're right, the world turns, things change. Maybe your goals change, maybe how it's functioning changes, or how the people want to use it is changing, or the people change. So, yeah, it requires going back. Landscape doesn't look at best necessarily at the ribbon cutting. It needs to grow in. It needs to be maintained. It needs to evolve. And so it does require a patience to see and learn from that over time.
Personally, I see that patience as one of the biggest challenges that we face. I often hear education cited as a barrier to sort of acceptance of more nature-based design approach. And I definitely think that that is true as well. But it also feels to me sometimes, at least in Deep Roots work, like we're fighting, like we just have a totally different worldview, basically. And we're trying to get people to see it as the long game, and that even if they understand the principles of why we take this approach, that if they're not willing to apply those values to the designed landscape, then it becomes sort of a moot point.
It's really hard. I think it's human nature to just do what you need to do now and not, it's hard to comprehend the future, especially in this changing world. But yeah, trees are considered disposable. You know, in my neighborhood, we're looking at, oh, the Historic Preservation Board wants to protect the viewshed of this building that is nearly 100 years old, but yet they're willing to chop down all the trees that create a nice entry to it that are over 100 years old. And it's like, wait a minute. Yeah, so it's frustrating. It's really frustrating because it takes a long time to grow a tree. But when you have a tree that is, I mean, like an old, mature tree, it's like a spiritual experience. I mean, it just speaks to you in a way that you can't get from anywhere else.
Barbara and her team have a lot of plans for advancing the Landscape Performance Series case studies. On the advocacy side, they want to get more case studies about other aspects of the landscape, like transportation, to enable those groups to advocate for their shared interests. They also want to target the kinds of projects that will get the attention of the people on the Hill who create green infrastructure policy. And on the research side, they'd like to do longer-term studies that track project performance over a full year or longer, and also to look across similar project types to see if they can draw conclusions about trends and performance.
We've kind of gone out opportunistically, and I think in the future we want to target more where content is to help drive some of these larger transformations. It's hard dealing with the city planning office and the HOA and the Urban Forestry Administration, if you have one, and all the different constituents that somehow are involved with, in this case, getting a tree in the ground and getting it done well so that the tree grows to what we want it to be. And trees and housing and everything in the landscape. So it is hard, but we do feel if there was an age of engineering and there was the age of architecture, that this is the age of landscape architecture. This is the time when the world needs what we have to offer.
If you want to read more about the work of the Landscape Architecture Foundation or browse the case study library, visit landscapeperformance.org. Remarkable Objects is produced and edited by me, Lita Meritz, with editorial assistance from Ilara Adekova. You can find us online at remarkableobjects.com and on Twitter at remarkableshow. This podcast is a production of DeepRoot Green Infrastructure. DeepRoot provides landscape solutions and technical support services to promote mature tree growth and sustainable stormwater management in the built environment. Find out more at deeproot.com. And if you like what we're doing, tell a friend or colleague about this podcast, or leave us a rating or review in iTunes, which helps us reach a broader audience. We really appreciate it. Thanks. Thank you.